going to turn on the tape recorder for those who I had a couple people who said that they wanted to be here but couldn't. And also, I usually get a couple other people who listen to this class afterwards, which is great. And I'm going to share a screen with you and show you this amazingly weird text. But as I promised, we're going to do the what I call the bumper sticker text first, because they're super easy and fun, and they won't take very long before we get into this question of gaslighting and truth. So again, Parshat Lech Lecha, the third Torah portion of the year. We're skipping over the stuff about Abraham going to a land that God will show him and circumcising himself and making a great nation of himself. We're going to get into some other stuff. So one of the things that happens at the end of the text is towards the end, God says to Abraham, quote, Vayotze otam hachutza vayomer habet na hashamayma usaper hakochavim im tukal lispor otam vayomer lo ko yihye zaracha. God took Abraham out, this is after the promise and after the circumcision, and said, look toward the heaven and count the stars if you are able to count them. And then he says, and God added, I don't know why it says in the English, and God added, it just says, and God said, so shall your offspring be. So fascinating, right? There are many questions here, okay? There are many questions here. By the way, one of the other things that also happens is God points Abraham to the sand and says, your offspring shall be as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand of the sea. And they're both interesting because we care about the specific language the Torah uses. And so since the Torah uses those two specific allusions, the stars in the sky and the sand in the sea, our commentators are interested in why sand and why stars. What's special about those things? And what larger message might one craft by taking the specifics of those allusions and applying them to the Israelites? So the Hasidim are interested in the personal meaning aspect of that. One of these is one of my favorite bumper sticker texts of all time, because I am a person of self-doubt who wonders whether I am doing well, whether I am being successful, whether I am meaningful, whether I'm living a worthwhile life. I struggle with that all the time. And one of our commentators goes there in a way that I would never have expected. So this is from Adonenu Moreinu V'Rabbeinu Rabbi Chaim of Tzanz, Rabbi Chaim Halberstam, who lived from 1793 to 1876. The Tzanzer Hasidim still exist today in kind of smaller numbers. He said this, from below, the stars look tiny. However, up there in the heavens, they are very great indeed. So this is a neat text because an earlier rabbi like Rashi or Rambam, who were living 1,000 years before, may or may not have been familiar with the works of Galileo or any of the science that was going on at the time, because it was basically forbidden to them, would not have fully understood what stars were, probably. So this is a rabbi who is contemporary enough that he understands astronomy, at least in a rudimentary fashion. He says he understands that stars are really small from our vantage point, but they're not tiny pinpricks of light that God puts up in the sky for fun. They're actually giant glowing balls of gas like our sun that are just really far away. And up close, they're very large. They're very great indeed. Okay, so he continues. So shall your offspring be. That's the quote from Torah. This is Israel, i.e., the Jewish people. Although I think you could make this argument for any non-Jewish person too, very easily. Down here on earth, they may seem small and lowly, but in the heavens above, they are important and very great indeed. So this is a beautiful teaching in the sense that why does God choose to use the allusion of stars here? It's because stars are really small from our vantage point, but from a God's eye view, they are massive balls of light, right? They are the things that give light and heat and energy to entire universes, to entire worlds. I think that's really valuable, right? The idea that I, in my in my lowest moment, in my biggest moments of self-doubt, can feel really bad about who I am or what I'm doing. But to someone else, I am very important, right? I am a life-giving source to others in my world, and you all are too. You are, and even if you are not to a specific individual in your life, your kids, your parents, your friends, your classmates, your colleagues, your library customers, right? You are infinitely valuable to God. And to remind yourself that you are infinitely valuable in the eyes of God and very great indeed, in the words of this rabbi, Rabbi the Tzanzer Rebbe, is really lovely. Okay, so I love that one. It's a great bumper sticker text. There's nothing bigger to pull out of it. And you can't argue with it, Marilyn. Okay. the second text I had a hard time pulling apart on Sunday. I did a little work on it. I figured it out. Okay, so this second text is from a really interesting guy. I'll give him the introduction before I tell you the text. I'm going to make it a little bit bigger. So this guy is a guy by the name of Rabbi Yehuda Meir Shapiro of Lublin. I did a little bit of digging and also kind of did some research about Lublin. There are many great Hasidim from Lublin, many great rabbis. Two of the great halachic decisors of all time, the Bach, Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, and another early halachic decisor, the Maharshal, are from Lublin. The Jose of Lublin, the prophet of Lublin, one of the early Hasidim, was also from this town. And Lublin was one of the most important Jewish centers of all time. It had a very advanced yeshiva that was once called the Oxford of the Jewish world until the Holocaust. And then after the destruction of European Jewry, it became a hospital in Poland, and then it became an elementary school. And then in the last 20 years, Poland decided to give the building back to the Jewish community. It is now serving as the Jewish community center for Lublin, which is administered by the JCC of Warsaw. So Jewish life renews eternal. Rabbi Yehuda Meir Shapiro of Lublin was this great rabbi. He wrote a book called The Or Meir. He was the founder of this thing that's really popular in America now called Daf Yomi, which is the daily study of a page of Talmud. We are on the 14th cycle of Daf Yomi since his passing. The other cool thing or sad thing, interesting thing about Rabbi Meir Shapiro is he died of typhoid, I think, in a typhoid outbreak in 1933 at just the age of 46. He was a young man and an extremely accomplished rabbi. So he writes a beautiful thing here. He says, it is known, so this is really interesting because it's a very different direction than the thing with the stars, and it's going to riff on the concept of not the word stars, but the word count. He's really interested in the fact that the text says, Habet na hashamayim usaper hakochavim, right? So glance heavenward and count the stars, im tuchal, if you can. So the if you can is really the important part here. It is known that if a person tried, they would be unable to count all the stars. Behold, one gazes heavenward and attempts to count, quote, thus shall your offspring be. And then he does this really interesting thing. He says three synonyms, which are really pretty in Hebrew and in English. One dares, one ventures, one strives towards that which is impossible, above that which is natural. Okay, so the beginning of the verse is God telling Abraham, look up at the stars and try and count them. You will not be able to. And that will be the number of your offspring. And the number of offspring thing is fun, but that's not the thing that Meir Shapiro is doing. Meir Shapiro is interested in the question, why would God point at the sky and tell Abraham, hey, count the stars. Ha ha, by the way, you can't. It's impossible, right? So it's this interesting moment, right? God says to Abraham, you know, count the stars, comma, you cannot do it. He asks Abraham to do a thing that is categorically impossible. Okay? He continues. Do not measure, this is what is referred to in homiletics and in speech writing as the reversible raincoat, where you take the phrase and you reverse it. So ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country is the most famous reversible raincoat in linguistics in human history. This one is a version of that that predates it. It's a little harder though. It's not as elegant. He says this, do not measure the desire according to the ability, rather measure the ability according to the desire. It's a little cryptic, and that's why I think I messed it up on Sunday, but here's what it means. Do not measure the desire according to the ability, I put it in parentheses, i.e., don't constrain yourself by what you think you can achieve, right? You have X ability, you say, this is as good, I can run a 10-minute mile. That's as fast as I can go. That's as good as it can get, right? The question then becomes, if I trained harder, could I do a 9:45 mile? Could I do a 9:30 mile? Could I do a 7-minute mile? Could I do a 6-minute mile, right? Do not constrain yourself by what you currently are able to achieve. Rather, measure your ability by your desire. Meaning, if you say you want to run a 6-minute mile, then damn it, you can run a 6-minute mile. And this applies to everything. If you don't think you can, you know, lose 10 pounds, you know, win an Academy Award, write the great American novel, you certainly will not be able to do it. But if you believe it, it is achievable, right? You can do it. This is like also, this is around the same time and or stealing from Im Tirtzu Ein Zo Agada, if you will it, it is no dream, which is Theodor Herzl's famous line. But it's pretty remarkable that it's kind of couched in these specific terms, riffing off of this verse of Torah, which is to say, God points at the stars and says, try and count them, you won't be able to. But God is doing it anyways. God is pointing and saying, try. Try and count the stars. The message is really cool because he ignores the part about, you know, your progeny will be like really large. His message is God looks at Abraham and says, try something impossible. Do it because you can achieve it because there are no limits to human possibility. I love that text. They're both bumper stickers, though, so they don't get into our bigger debate. All right, now we're going to go back and do the hard text with the 28-ish minutes we have left to go. It's a bit of a long walk, so I apologize if this is a little weird. I'm going to ask for a volunteer reader who wants to do the English because you guys are all probably sick of my voice at this point. Rich, will you read this? I will screen share it on the screen for you. I did not include the Hebrew because we don't really need it, and I wanted to make it quicker. But this is the backstory from the Torah to the thing that we're going to read. All right, Rich, I'm gonna scroll as soon as you get to the bottom of 12. We're going to 15. Start reading as soon as you're ready.
8. Then the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar, went forth and engaged them in battle in the valley of Siddim. 9. King Chedorlaomer.
Wow.
of Elam, king title of Goim, king Amraphel of Shinar, and king Arioch of Elasar, 4 kings against those 5. Now the valley of Siddim was dotted with bitumen pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah in their flight threw themselves into them, while the rest escaped to the hill country. The invaders seized all the wealth of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. They also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, and his possessions and departed, for he had settled in Sodom or Sodom. A fugitive brought the news to Abram the Hebrew, who was dwelling at the terebinths of Mamre the Amorite, kinsman of Eshcol and Aner, these being Abram's allies. When Abram heard that his kinsman had been taken captive, he mustered his retainers, born into his household, numbering 318, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. At night, He and his servants deployed against them and defeated them, and he pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus.
All right, great. Thank you, Rich. All right, first of all, one, I'm bringing you a text from Lech Lecha that probably every Reform and conservative rabbi who has ever lived has skipped, right? This is the story of the four kings, the war of the four kings versus the war of the five kings. I actually skipped four lines before, which gives you the backstory to that war, which is that these groups have allied against each other and gone to war before. I find this text fascinating for lots and lots of reasons. One, we get a very different view of Abraham or Abram at this point, which is he is a warrior chieftain. He is not this humble dude wandering around with tents. He is the leader of a clan, and he engages in clan warfare. I think this would make a great movie, right? You know, you cast some really handsome, swarthy Jewish actor in the modern period, and you put him in the Middle East, and you make him like a warrior king. Like, this is like Game of Thrones stuff. It's super fun. You know, he can muster 318 men on a whim and support one side in a war versus another and rescue Lot, his nephew, right? So the other piece that's interesting out of this text is we get some of the backstory for the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, which appears in the next Torah portion, Vayera. You know, we kind of know Lot as this random dude who kind of shows up living in Sodom, and Abraham has to save him. Apparently, the Abraham has to save Lot motif is a recurring one in Torah. Lot is kind of a hot mess ne'er-do-well, and Avram probably gets like a message every couple of weeks like, hey, your nephew's in trouble again. Damn it. You know, this is that guy in your family who the family's always raising bail for. You know, it's like, Uncle Joey's in trouble again. Ugh, Uncle Joey, right? That's Lot. He's always in trouble. So that's an interesting thing. And we get one other reference that I don't think I'd ever noticed before, which is also in the Vayera story, next week's Torah portion. We learn that Abram has pitched his tent by the terebinths of Mamre, right? The Ilone Mamre. Ilon is probably is often translated in modern Hebrew as oak, but it might be some kind of special pillar. And Mamre might be a guy, but it also might be a place. Depends on which commentator you ask. So all of this is interesting backstory, but that's not really what we're definitely focused on, although I do want to point out that Rich pronounced the word Cherdo Laomer so well. So well. I was so impressed. I was like, ah, he's going to botch this one, but he got it. So verse 10 is the one that our commentators are interested in. And they're gonna read that story by reading two other stories against it and then making a Hasidic commentary against that. So if you're wondering why did we skip to the bumper sticker short, quick text first, it's because it's a long walk to talk about truth and faith through this story. So here's what happens. So verse 10 says, now the valley of Sidim was dotted with bitumen pits. Bitumen is one translation. Tar is another word. The word is chemar in Hebrew, and nobody really knows what this is. So it's bitumen or pitch, or tar, and Rashi is going to go a different way. Based on the Talmud, he's going to translate it as, in Hebrew, teet, which is known as mortar. So like clay mortar that you would use on a hut, right? But it's a pit. And the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, in their flight, threw themselves into them, while the rest escaped to the hill country. Now, the pshat of the verse would imply that the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, like, were cowards, and rather than be defeated in battle, they drowned themselves in a pit of tar, right? But that's not what the commentaries are going to say. And Breishit Rabbah, the Midrash, is actually going to say that they dove into these pits and emerged alive and survived, right? Which is really interesting. Which is really interesting and very strange. So all of that is kind of the back knowledge that you need to know in order to kind of take a look at this verse. So the verse goes on. And our text is from a book that I finally, after many years of looking for it, found online called The Otzer HaMachshava Shel HaChassidut, which is a work that a compendium text that was written by Rabbi Shabtai Weiss I also was gifted by the president of my congregation for the first time in my 13-year career as a rabbi, a discretionary fund. I have $300 in my discretionary fund now. And so for the first $20 of my discretionary fund, I bought this book. Yay, discretionary fund. Okay. The text, this guy, Rabbi Shabtai Weiss, wrote this compendium in 1949. It's kind of lost to the sands of time. It was hard to find. It's way out of print. And I found a copy. But this is actually from our favorite book, the Itarei Torah, Rabbi Ginsburg's compendium, which includes compendiums of other compendiums. Okay, so a midrash. These were pits that mortar were mixed in. Okay, so the translation of the text says that they were pits of bitumen, chemar, but Rashi doesn't agree. Rashi thinks that they're mortar pits, and they're not naturally occurring tar pits like the La Brea tar pits in California, but rather they are pits that you would take all of your mortar and you would pour it into, right? Imagine those like troughs that people buy at Home Depot, and then they get the concrete and the water and they put all the stuff in there and they mix the concrete in them. That's what these are, basically. These were pits that mortar was mixed in, and a miracle occurred for the king of Sodom so that he could escape from there. This happened. This is a very strange Rashi, but you need to take the walk to get to where we're going. This happened because there were non-Jews who did not believe that Abraham was saved at Ur Kasdim from the fiery furnace. But once the king of Sodom escaped from the mortar, they believed the story of Abraham. So this is Rashi's comment on here. Audrey's already like, oh man, this is complicated. So what's going on here? The question is, why is the Torah, the simple question that Rashi's asking is, why is the Torah giving us this random detail about the battle of the four kings and the battle of the five kings, and two of the kings diving into a pit of bitumen, right? How does that advance the narrative of Abraham, our patriarch? Why would the Torah include this seemingly unnecessary detail unless it has some sort of moral component for us? And the answer that we're given is, we're going to compare it against a similar story that is in the Midrash. The similar story, I knew immediately, but I had to go and look up the citation, is the story of Abraham and the fiery furnace at Ur Kasdim, which is a midrash which is very clearly similar to the book of Daniel, where Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego jump into a fiery furnace and they survive, right? They are thrown into a fiery furnace by the king of Babylonia, King Nebuchadnezzar, and because the three of them, the three Jews, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, refuse to bow down to the king, right? They emerge, they live in the fire, and they're perfectly fine, and they emerge unscathed. And a giant fire bursts forth and kills their tormentors. And from that day forth, they change their names to Azrael, Mishael, and Azariel, I think are their names that they come up with. But by the way, the Beastie Boys have a great song called Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Highly recommended. Three MCs that were on the go. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. Okay, so that's a story in Daniel. And the story of Abraham in Bereishit Rabbah, a rabbinic midrash from at least 800 years after the book of Daniel, is basically a mirror image, parenthetically, possibly a full-blown copy. Which is to say that Abraham living, the story goes like this, and it's from Midrash Rabbah 38. Abraham is living in Babylonia, and Nimrod, the king, says to him, bow down to me. And he says, I won't do it. And Nimrod says, I'm throwing you in a fiery furnace. He says, great. He throws him in the fiery furnace, and God saves him. And Nimrod says, well, if Abraham can do it, then I can do it. And King Nimrod walks into the fiery furnace and gets cooked to a crisp, right? And this is a story about the faith of Abraham. Okay, a long walk for this whole question about faith and belief and truth, right? So we're going to see what they're going to do with it in a second. But just real quick so that you understand what's going on, there are two stories that are being juxtaposed one against another. There's the story of the king of Sodom who dives into a pit of bitumen and, according to Rashi, survives, right? So it's a miracle. and the story of Abraham, who jumps into a fiery furnace and survives, and it is a miracle. So the question is still, so Rashi's kind of answering the question. And Rashi's answer is, the reason this story of the king of Sodom is brought is because people were wandering around saying, Abraham didn't have any miracles done for him. Abraham doesn't have any miraculous powers. Abraham didn't actually go into a fiery furnace and survive. So God goes, ah, okay, I'll prove it to you, right? The king of Sodom, he's going to dive into a pit of tar and he'll emerge. And you'll all go, ah, it's a miracle. The king of Sodom lives. And if you can suspend your belief that the king of Sodom could jump into a pit of bitumen, all the more so you could suspend your belief and believe that Abraham could go into a fiery furnace and survive. So that's Rashi's move, right? Rashi's move is to say the reason the Torah brings us the story is to show that God works in specifically mysterious ways to help human beings to believe that which is unbelievable, right? Human beings are given an opportunity to believe that what they would think was a miracle before was a fact that they witnessed by their own eyes, right? So very interesting. So we're going to go more. Ramban, so Rabbi Nachmanides, Moses ben Nachman, who lived until 1274 in the city of Girona, Spain, was a great Kabbalist and a biblical commentator. He said he had a problem with it. So if you look in one of our other books, you'd find this commentary by Ramban. And his problem with it is, adrabba, on the contrary. It's the exact opposite that what Rashi says, right? Rashi's explanation is, if they can believe the king of Sodom jumps into the pit and survives, then they can definitely believe that Abraham can do it. On the contrary, now that the king of Sodom has been saved, can we also make the case that Abraham's saving was also not a miracle, that it all occurred in a natural manner, right? So Rashi's making the case, miracles happen every day. And this story about the king of Sodom was proof text that a miracle could happen to Abraham too. Ramban very cleverly goes the other direction. He goes, not a miracle there and not a miracle here, right? People jump into fiery furnaces all the time and survive, right? People jump into tar pits all the time and survive. That's normal, right? These people could see it. So Ramban has a real problem with Rashi's answer. Ramban would probably end up saying the reason that the Torah tells us that the king of Sodom jumped into a pit of bitumen was that the king of Sodom jumped into a pit of bitumen, right? It's like a factual thing that happened, and we don't need a deep Torahitic reason for it. All right, all that is the backstory for our Hasidic commentator. All that is just set up, right? Because right now what we have is a brilliant moment where Rashi and Ramban are disagreeing with each other about what is a miracle and what is not. What is fact and what is not. What is the normal way in the world and what is a miracle? It's a fascinating question. So the Chedushei Horim, one of our favorite guys, Rabbi Yitzhak Meir Alter of Ger, who's the founder of the Ger Hasidic community and the grandfather, of course, of one of my favorite dudes, the Sfat Emet, the language of truth, who lived Rabbi Yehuda Alter of Ger, who died in 1935. So the Chedushei Horim explains it thusly. There is truth, is a beautiful sentence. There is truth and there is faith. There is Emet and there is Emunah. So here he's getting there. Truth is a marvelous thing that everyone agrees because it comes by the hand of God. Okay, I'm going to explain that sentence by itself just because you might misunderstand the concept of the hand of God. The Chedushei Harim here is using truth in a way that is like not, quote, the hand of God faith, but like more like he's really talking about the possibility and those moments in society and in human life where something is actually objectively true, where 100% of people would point and agree and say, yeah, the sky is blue, right? Like absolute objective truth. The Chedushei Harim says truth is a marvelous thing, and the fact that it happens is by the hand of God. It's amazing when we have actual objective truth. And he's kind of implying here that it's very rare, because the word he uses for marvelous is pella, which is also the Hebrew word for wondrous, or kind of, it's in the same root as miraculous, right? He almost says that objective truth is the real miracle. It is so rare for everyone to agree to a thing that it is very, very rare, right? I'm a sports fan. When you see a guy being called out at first base and everyone points and goes, he was out, right? It's a great thing. And it's unfortunately fairly rare, because sometimes, you know, when you watch a good baseball game, half the people in the stands shout, he's safe, and the other half shout, he's out. Okay. However, regarding a miracle, it is possible that one could cast doubt as to whether it is a miracle. So this is that thing that Ramban said, right? You look at something and one person says, it's a miracle. And another person says, miracle, unlikely that it happened, right? Like one man's miracle, one person's miracle is another person's happenstance occurrence, one in a billion occurrence. Only from the divine side of things, and only one gifted with faith or belief, the Hebrew word is the same for both. Emunah is either faith or belief. It can be one, both at the same time. The Hebrew language isn't precise enough to have a synonym for both. Only from the divine side of things, and only one gifted with faith would agree with it. Thus, a miracle is in the midah, the provenance of faith. So miracles, just believing something is a miracle, is already an act of faith. Okay. The miracle at Ur Kasdim was completely obvious to the eyes of all that witnessed it, that it came from God. Okay, the miracle at Ur Kasdim is the fiery furnace story. So the miracle of Abraham going into a fiery furnace was not a miracle, because everyone saw it. And it was an objective fact. It was a thing that happened, right? So a person, this is very interesting, right? A thing can be a miracle that 100% of witnesses say, yeah, it actually exactly happened that way, which is counterintuitive to the way we think of a miracle, right? When a person sees, you know, like, so a guy could turn to you and say, God's honest truth, a hawk flew down from the sky, picked up my hot dog, flew it across the street, and dropped it into a mailbox at the same time as a lady was putting her ballot into it, and the ketchup got all over the ballot and ruined it. And that, by the way, shifted the entire county, which shifted the entire state, which gave the election to right? Like, a miracle occurred. And the reality, according to this text, is if 100 people were there and all 100 people would attest to the fact that and say, yeah, I saw the hawk and I saw the hot dog and I saw the ketchup and I saw the election, it all happened exactly the way he said it, then it's not a miracle, right? It is a miracle in the sense that it's a strange thing that happens. But it's not a miracle because it's completely obvious to the eyes of all that witnessed it. So now we're getting into this area of a miracle already being a thing that is subjective, right? Fascinating. Okay. This was within the boundaries of truth, right? So this could be a thing. It could actually happen. A person could go into a fiery furnace and emerge and be okay. A person could dive into a pit of bitumen and survive. A hawk could pick up a hot dog and ruin the entire 2020 election. It could happen, right? These are real things, right? Therefore, after the events of the king of Sodom, there opened a place to question and cast doubt also regarding Ur Kasdim, since the same thing happened to the king of Sodom, who was a non-Jew, right? So everybody saw the king of Sodom dive into the pit of bitumen and survive, and then they went, wow, a miracle happened. But they could also have said, you know, there were all these people who saw Abraham go into the fiery furnace. Did they really see him go into a fiery furnace, right? You're starting to cast doubt. You're starting to gaslight the narrative, right? Everybody believes that a thing that actually happened happened until a bunch of other people say, did it really happen? Did you really see that with your own eyes? Maybe you didn't see the hawk grab the hot dog, right? Maybe that didn't happen, right? You can gaslight away a whole election, unfortunately, in the parlance and the examples of our time. You can cast serious doubt, right? Go back to the 2000 election. The state of Florida had a bunch of hanging chads. And the question is, literally, we decided election by a whole bunch of people standing around and wondering, is that Chad hanging or is it fully detached? Did that person punch out that spot or not? Which is why no state in the union uses these little punch thingies anymore. Although you and I all probably remember the old days when we actually punched out the things. But anyways, point being, like, we're putting things into subjective categories of truth and reality, and to the point where we're taking things that everybody would formally agree and say that is a truth and say, is it really a truth? Is that really true? All right, let's keep going. We're almost done. Thus, the matter Ur Kasdim becomes a matter of faith, right? So an act of objective reality that is at the beginning of this text was described as emet, as a true thing that happened, becomes an act of emuna. So a truth becomes something of faith. This is what Rashi means. And thus they believed, they had faith in, the story of Abraham. Okay, so I think the ending, and this is arguable, right? This is a somewhat nebulous text. But I think the ending is a bit of a postmodern read of the idea of objective truth and belief and faith. It's a smushing together of a lot of the things that Marilyn led off with beautifully by kind of explaining, which is saying that faith is an essential quality of human beings, even in matters of truth. Because Ur Kasdim is laid out at the beginning as a thing that actually happened. And yet we look back at it as a thing that a person has to have belief in, right? You have to hold on to faith in things that are emet, the things that are true, right? One has to kind of put the two of them together into a blender in order to be able to walk away in this life with a sense of meaning and purpose, to believe that it's all right and it's all true and it's all good. It's a little bit hard to kind of say that there are things that are objectively true and that no one can ever disagree with. Everything based on this text requires a certain amount of faith and belief. You have to invest yourself in something to a degree that even the most, and by the way, the thing I like about this text is it takes the idea of miracle, which I think a lot of people put very, very clearly, you know, miracles are things that people of faith believe. And facts and objective truth is a thing that people of science believe. And our rabbi, the Chidushei Harim, says, yeah, it's not that simple, right? It's actually a lot messier than that, because people have to believe with faith even in truths, right? Because to some degree, like, and I think we have this a little bit with COVID, I'll conclude-ish on this and open it up to other folks. I know that this one's complicated and it doesn't really land in a clear place, and that's a good thing. I'm okay with that, right? That's a place we should be okay with sometimes, that it's a complicated text which is subjective. You know, there are folks out there who say, I don't know anybody who has COVID, and therefore the whole thing is a hoax, right? This is one of those examples where truth and faith come in to play, right? A person's objective reality is that they don't think this thing exists because they don't know anybody who has it. And yet they have to believe in faith in other people out in the world who say, yeah, actually, I do know people who have COVID or who had COVID. And I do know that people have died of this, and you should take this very, very seriously, right? I am lucky or not lucky enough to have had a friend who got it very early. You can Google this article. The first outbreak of COVID before it happened in Seattle happened at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, a whole bunch of Chinese visitors who came from Wuhan were seen on the last day of the conference flying out of the Las Vegas airport, and all of them were sick. And my buddy who was at the show for – he works for Google – flew home and told his wife, like, I feel really, really bad. And he spent a week in bed. And only later did we find out, like, yeah, he actually had COVID-19. He was one of the earliest people in America to catch this thing. You know, because I know someone who had it and I know it was horrible, I believe it, right? But I have faith because I listen to other people and I believe their truth. So it's interesting that one can say miracles are subjective. Truth is something that is maybe not subjective, but it is something that you still have to believe in, right? It is not neat and clean to say that some things are objectively true, emet, and other things are acts of faith that we have to believe in. It is not simple to say X is a miracle and meaning it's only miraculous and it can't happen in real life, right? And to kind of finish, I guess we could say we human beings in the modern era need to be able to open ourselves up to the possibility that the term miracle does not refer only to, you know, things that are beyond science, but they have to be things that are believed to be, you know, amazing and wondrous and fantastical and also objectively, verifiably truthful occurrences, like a hawk with a hot dog in the mail slot. Okay, and that is the name of our shiur for today, the hawk and the hot dog in the mail slot. All right, excellent job. I would love to hear any comments on this if anyone has any thoughts. I know this one was a bit messy, and I like it when it gets a little bit messy sometimes. But I did give you those two bumper sticker texts to start off with if you wanted them. Any thoughts? Go ahead, Rana.
I recently was in a discussion with someone about faith and how religion really is a matter of faith rather than subjective truth, because we believe what we read, we believe what we're taught, and our faith, Judaism being our faith, is just as valid as the faith of our neighbor whose faith might be whatever the title of it is. I was saying to somebody that people whom I respect who are very well educated might be Christian or whatever, and they absolutely believe as strongly as I believe the teachings that they have. And even though I might find their teachings to be unbelievable, you know, it's not possible, they're just as comfortable with their beliefs as I am. And because of that, I always find it hard to imagine that people change religions, because there's so much of like indoctrination, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but you know, it's fed to us in everything we do as we grow, that it's hard to imagine that someone who is of a faith can leave that and choose another set of miracles to believe in. Just a thought.
It's really well said. I think that you drew a line between two meanings of the word faith, which I think was really valuable and really good, which is we talk about faith as a thing that you decide to believe in, but the broader context of the word is a faith, right? A religion that you follow, and that people of different faiths can have, to kind of conclude your thought, which was really beautiful, can have truth, right? There can be truth in a devout Christian. There could be truth in a devout Buddhist. There could be truth in a devout Muslim that is capital T true for them, but not for me, right? Like they arrive at a place that is spiritually valuable and meaningful and right, and yet it is not my faith. It is not, I can believe that it is emet, that it is true, without it being emunah, without having belief in it. So that's a nice read of those things together. By the way, the other thing is, and this was to Phil's point at the beginning, he was like, is this going to be one of those things where the rabbis ultimately end, like, believe in God? And the answer is no, they kind of don't. They end up in a really weird, nebulous place that's totally different than that, which says, you know, give in to subjectivity and be okay with it being a little bit. Now, we certainly know that the Chiddushei HaRim would ultimately say, like, trust in Hashem and you'll be okay. But they understand that the concept of faith isn't as rock solid as we believe it to be, that you have to, you know, say something. All right, Renee wants to say something. Go ahead.
Following that, what Rana has said, it may be a question that Jews by choice, okay, rather than saying Jews who, people who have converted, Jews by choice have realized or changed their truths. Or it can work the other way. I mean, Jews who become Buddhists, although I don't know if it was this class or another class where they said you don't have to give up your Jewish beliefs to be Buddhist, but maybe we are allowed to change our truths.
Great book about that, Jewish Buddhists, is The Jew and the Lotus by Roger Kamenetz. Highly recommended. They sent a bunch of Jewish Buddhists to meet the Dalai Lama. So I really like that. I really like the idea of asking the question what it means for individuals to change faiths. Having been a rabbi who's presided over at least 150 conversions and read all the statements of why people do it, I get it and I understand it. You know, it's the coming of an individual to a new set of truths that are more suitable to who they are as a person now. But the other piece that is related to a thing that I talked about with some other folks this week is the question of the Jew by choice kind of idea. In the modern era, we are all Jews by choice, right? I have lots of friends and relatives who grew up Jewish but practice no appreciable version of Judaism today. We all choose kind of how to believe in or to adhere to the strictures of our faith and our people. So our faith, our belief, our truths are kind of constantly changing throughout time, and they may adjust. We may become more or less spiritual throughout time. Yeah. I don't know if that answered the question, but it was a riff. It was a riff. I don't know that Rana or Renee are asking questions rather than just saying really brilliant things. Any other comments? Go ahead, Phil.
I just thought maybe the last text is definitely a little bit baffling. It feels like you can read it in a lot of different ways. I thought it seemed almost like an explanation to people to the question, why do people need to see something to believe it? It almost seems like somebody was asking him, hey, I met some guy that doesn't believe this or that, and they say it's because they didn't happen to them or they don't know anybody. It seems like an answer to that question. Like, well, you know, here's an example of why. You know, that's what it seems like to me.
Right. I think that's nice. I think the question of like, so these guys saw a thing and they all believed it, but these other guys say it didn't happen. So to him, it kind of proved the point that, like, seeing is not necessarily believing, right? One can see something and say it's a miracle, and another person can see something and say, it just happens. That's just normal, right? So I thought that was an interesting facet of that. But you're right. This text has multiple kind of like angles to it, and it doesn't end neatly. Marilyn, go ahead, and then Paula, and then we'll call it a day.
I just think that in that regard, that it's actually a very interesting and important passage, particularly today, because and this is the problem we have with social media, is their failure to check for things. We can now Photoshop to such a degree that you cannot identify a fake. And so what you see is not what you can believe. It is the exact opposite. And most people don't even know what to look for, if you can even find it in some of the more technically high-end fakes. that are out there in terms of images. And so it really is, I think, a problem of simply being human in and living our lives as we live them, that we cannot be certain about everything. We cannot. It's impossible. And so we have to find a way to help ourselves be the most comfortable we can be with what we can be, so to speak.
There are several, I mean, this is a great example. Facebook is dealing with a problem. There are several websites that have been getting in trouble online because they will print something that is not true. And then when they're called on it and they said, you printed an absolute fabrication, some of them have replied, it was satire, right? Our president has said some of the same things. Like he'll say something and then he'll say, no, that was a joke, right? I think his Bleach comment was like kind of, bye Phil, was kind of referenced as, oh no, that was a joke. And for those of us who watched the video, we're like, I don't think you were kidding, dude. I think you were being serious. So, but you know, that's this very strange, like, you know, is it true? There are people who are out there faking tweets and faking Facebook posts. And there's entire fake accounts on Twitter of people pretending to be rabbis. And it's pretty messy out there. And so if it doesn't feel true, it's maybe not, but we're definitely getting into that realm. All right, we have one last comment. Someone else had their hand up, and I don't know. Paula, you were going to go.
For me, truth has always been what is concrete, what's in front of me, what I can see. But part of that is trusting your source, which is what Marilyn was saying. I mean, she trusts the Boston Globe. You can read everything she puts on Facebook every single morning. But your truth has to be what you can trust. And I think it's very personal, and I think it's very different. And there's a lot of things I can say. Thank you for all the wonderful stories we've heard and read this morning. Because to me, I don't believe any of it. It's just stories because I have no fact. But when I walk at 6:30 or 6:45 in the morning, and I see the night breaking and the day starting, and I say, well, this is both God and this is both science, and it's working together. And to me, the fact that we're going to have one day after another, be it cloudy or sunny, is my truth, because that I can see, and there's nothing questionable about the fact. So basically, you need to trust your source.
It's beautiful. I'll finish on this thought. That's a great place to end. I have one, my thought, and mine's a little over more simple, but I use this all the time in my classes. You know, one of the fundamental questions around Torah that Paul is raising is whether it is, you know, actual, factual, historical truth. I have this book that Debbie Firestone gave me called The Archaeology of the Bible. It's from the National Geographic. And it kind of throws out stuff about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, assuming that they are real individuals who really existed. I don't know, cover your ears if you don't like heresy, I don't know that Abraham actually existed as a real person and that he was not a literary character. However, I also love the Star Wars TV series or movies, and I've watched them many times. And for me, I know Luke Skywalker like the back of my hand. I know who he is and what he's like. And so Luke Skywalker, a fictional character, is as real to me in terms of the truths that he offers, regardless of the fact that he was not an actual historical figure. The same applies for me with Abraham. Whether Abraham existed or not in reality is not nearly as important to me as the capital T truths that Abraham teaches me and the reality of his actual and Sarah's existence back then. So that's kind of the kind of ending note of truth. Oh, Paula, say what you were going to say.
A rabbi. I was a teacher at Beth Sholem, fourth grade Hebrew school, the only year I did not get thrown out because I liked what he said. And we were reading and translating Bereishis, which I don't know how functional that is learning Hebrew down the line, but we were doing that. And in the middle of it all, he said, the only thing I'm going to tell you is some of the stories and some of the things you hear are strictly stories to illustrate a point. Do not believe anything. You have to extrapolate what works for you and what is your reality. And that was the only year, like I said. He was wonderful. I don't know that he was in Pittsburgh very long. I don't know what happened to him, but he was wonderful. My yeah. only year not thrown out.
Right. Finding truth is, I think, the final lesson for today, that we are all on a quest to find what is true, both in the broader sense and for ourselves. That's our class for today.